It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about, especially here in Pennsylvania, where I am located. I got to tell you, the Republicans here in this state never cease to amaze, and the lengths that they will go, no barriers. They are willing to do whatever it is, like a whiny child in a cereal aisle demanding its Fruit Loops. This is the Republican Party of today. There's no principle here. There's no ideology. There's no core value. There's none of that stuff. This is temper tantrum zone. This is kissing the orange ring, surrounded by the two giant cheeks. This is the new Republican Party. This is the party of, I don't get what these guys are thinking. And I'm going to start off with a quote that grabbed me today. Senate President pro tempore Jake Corman. He told the Philadelphia Inquirer, top Republican, told the Philly Inquirer that investigating the election, that pursuing the things that I'm going to tell you about here in a second, the most important thing in front of the Republicans this legislative session, going back and hashing out old grievances and relitigating failed lawsuits and attempting to revive busted myths of the past, that the most important thing in front of the legislature right now. Don't worry about people being evicted from their homes. Don't worry about the virus. Don't worry about people getting jobs. Don't worry about small businesses trying to stay afloat. Don't worry about any of that. Kids getting education, roads and bridges. The thousands of other things, not important. Most important thing right now. There are 17 subpoenas that they have approved through a Senate subcommittee. These 17 subpoenas are going to be for all personal information on every single voter in this state. Understand what they're saying. The Republicans want all of the information, all of the voter information, all of it. They want all of it. They want to centralize all of the information into their slimy little hands. Now remember the argument for having 67 different counties and 67 different election officers and 67 different sets of rules to make sure that our elections aren't hacked or fiddled with is that our diversity is our strength. What the Republicans are pushing forth right now is to grab all of that information for themselves. All of it. Now, here's the thing that I'm coming back to. They want a cyber ninja kind of thing that we saw in Arizona to where we hand over the machines to a private industry. Who knows what they did with them? And in fact, Arizona is going to pay the cost because they have to get rid of those machines and get new ones because we have no idea what they did to them. But this is what the Republicans in this state want. They want to relitigate all of the things that have already been thrown out of courts across this country, this state. There have been multiple lawsuits. I don't know that there's anything that has been as litigated as the 2020 election, and yet they want more. And at every step of the way, every one of their failed arguments has been thrown out. You had the county audits, you had the state audits. There were no issues found. They couldn't find anything. No voter fraud. They couldn't find it. And trust me, they were looking. This is one of those moments where you go, what are they really trying to do? Because, I don't know if you saw the video recently. Ron Johnson, the senator from Wisconsin, candidly when he thought he was speaking to a friendly audience, said, yeah, we know Trump lost. We know there was no rigging going on. We knew. This is all for show. And understand, most of the Republicans, someone like Cormann, because I think he's a smart guy, knows this is all just a sham. This is political theater. This is to get keep the base all bunched up in the panties, all lathered up. Now, there are a handful of crazy ones. There are, and we know who they are, that are true believers. They've sold the soul to the Trump demon. But the rest of the party, they're scared to death. And it's interesting to me that the people of power, the people in power, are afraid. They're afraid of the former guy. They're afraid of the rabid base that has taken over the Republican Party. They're afraid of the Q kooks who have made threats and done all kinds of crazy stuff, who show up to school board meetings and the lunacy that comes out of that. But when I see our statesmen, the people who are supposed to be our representatives, the people who we entrust our democratic process with, the people that we've put in charge of representing us in this incredible experiment of self-governance, when I see them cower to this kind of blatant attempt, really this kind of blatant attempt to intimidate voters, to gather information to hand over to private interests for whatever means. And look, if they get it, this will be a major, major undertaking that taxpayers are going to pay for. And what will they do with the information? We may never know. Because these people don't work for us. But as I was reading through this, and the governor's right. I think Governor Wolf is absolutely right. The information that they are requesting is just another step to undermine our democracy. This is all about undermining the sanctity of the ballot box, undermining trust in our ballot, in our ballots, and really to catapult the propaganda of the last guy. Revive those conspiracy theories. This is a direct and continual assault on our electoral process. Because they know they're not going to win elections in the future. They've got to do what they can do to restrict people from voting. And ultimately, they want the power to overturn elections. This is what they're working towards. They're working towards having the ability to go, you know what, we really don't agree with the will of the people. We know better. And all we have to do is claim that there were some irregularities. Oh, we found something, even if they created it. And they can install whoever they wanted. Now, look, I still know people who think Trump's going to be reinstalled. As kooky as that sounds, I still do. But I guess that's no more kooky than our state Senate going, we're going to subpoena the records of every single citizen in this state. Let that sink in. The party of small, less intrusive government, the party of local control, they're the ones who are consolidating your information, taking your information. It's scary stuff. But here's the thing, and I look at our wimps in the state Senate who are just going along, and I believe there are a lot of them who know this is all just a bunch of nonsense, but they're going to go along because we don't want to face an angry electorate. And I understand why average, everyday working people feel fear. And I guess there's a part of me that goes, if someone in a power position is as skittish and as fearful of consequences, I shouldn't be surprised that average, everyday working people are as well. And I had this really interesting conversation with a woman today who basically hates her job. The hours are way too long. The wages haven't kept up. She's struggling to make her payments. Her health insurance is terrible. There's no retirement security there if she gets to stay there long enough to get it. And she's treated horribly. Yet fearful, literally fear in her eyes when I suggested that maybe she consider joining with her coworkers and forming a union. And it was that fear that wasn't just her. I had the opportunity to talk to a bunch of people who, you know, they all say the same thing. They're being worked to death. They don't feel like the essential workers that they were called or the frontline heroes. They feel like they're being abused. But once you start saying you can stand up, you can speak out, you have rights, they start to back off. Especially when the boss, when the owners, when the hierarchy looks down upon them. And it was interesting watching people's reactions. I'm someone who likes to see how people react in situations. And, you know, interestingly enough, there are people who are scared to death to talk about how they can make their lives better in the private sector. Now, these are all people who, interestingly enough, when you wanted to talk about politics and how bad government is, they were emboldened to say how horrible that is and take it out on on someone they didn't like. But in something that could actually make their lives better, it was quite remarkable to me. And I'm not surprised. Look, this isn't new. But it's another one of those things that, you know, when you're confronted with it again, when people are telling you how difficult their lives are, when they're telling you how difficult, coming to work and being treated poorly and in difficult conditions, when they tell those stories, I can only go, well, how can we help? How can you make that better? How can you do more? How can you pull yourself up? And me, as someone who believes in unions and the power of organizing, the power of collective bargaining, that's the club out of the bag. This is what you should be working towards. Once you start saying, hey, we're going to band together to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, we're going to be moving forward in a concerted way, you have protections, you have rights. And the boss doesn't want you to know that. They want you to look over your shoulder. And it was amazing watching people, you know, as soon as you said, hey, you know, this is how you can make your life better. The way the head snapped around looking for the boss. And he was there looking over their shoulder, intimidating them. So when I think about looking at the people who we think should have the power to stand up and defend rights and to do the right thing, our legislators, I guess I'm not as hard on average everyday working people who are just trying to make a living. And I had someone, you know, say, well, you know, if they don't like it, one of the management people said, if they don't like it here, they can go somewhere else. And the reality is they can't. Because the conditions are the same, the place next door, the conditions are the same, if not worse, down the road. The conditions are the same, if not worse, around the block, across town, across the country. It's all the same. Long hours. Low wages. Expensive health care. Retirement security that doesn't exist. And voiceless and powerless. And, you know, I had a conversation today with someone who, you know, I trust and I respect. And I said, you know, to me, this is why people are so angry at their government, because it's the outlet that they're allowed to have. It's the outlet that corporate America has gone, yeah, go beat them up. It's the outlet that's acceptable in those places. Because ultimately, as long as we're divided, as long as we're pitted against each other, as long as we're at each other's throats over one nonsensical thing or another, we're not looking back at them. Because when the boss came through the exit line, he was driving a $100,000 vehicle. The poor working stiffs that I saw, they were driving 20-year-old Hondas and Toyotas and Fords and Chevys. They were driving cars that were barely getting through an inspection, and they were coming out exhausted. Because a lot of the conversations started off, man, you look whipped. Yeah, long day. You go, every day. That's how it is every day. Well, you can do something about that. Oh, no, I can't do that. quite remarkable to me. And the more I look at this stuff and the more I talk about how, you know, in my lifetime, how union membership has made my life better and other workers better, I think it's important to share those stories and the wins. And look, this year, a good year for labor wins. In fact, you know, Nabisco has been on strike in several locations across the country. Same thing, long hours, you know, wages that haven't kept up, wanting to claw back overtime protections and things that have been longstanding, you know, things that workers need. I understand there is a tentative agreement. We don't know the details as of yet. But the union representing the Nabisco workers, the BCTGM, they've reported that there is something, and it's going to be voted on in the coming days. Now, this doesn't mean that the strike's over. This doesn't mean that it's going to end tomorrow. This means there's going to be a vote on the contract. Democracy in the workplace. People having the right to go, okay, this is what's being offered. We can take it, or we continue to be on strike. This, to me, is the perfect scenario. And every person that I talked to today was like, you know, this company's making incredible amounts of money. And at every opportunity, they're nickel and diming us. And we're not the heroes and the essential workers that everyone thinks they were. They don't treat us like that because we're disposable. We're at will. And these are things that I think are really important to talk about in this moment. Because in this moment, the employer class is being nice because they have to. There's, quote unquote, a shortage. This is the moment where you negotiate your gains, but you get it in writing so that you don't lose it. And this isn't rocket science. You don't have to be a genius to figure this out. The second corporate America figures that they can take things back, they're going to. So if you're not happy, you can change things. If things aren't what you want, you can change things. You just have to be willing to join together. And that's the important part. You have to join together and stand together. It's not that difficult. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. What are your horror stories? Are you working long hours, low pay, all that still the reality of the workforce? I'd love to hear it. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win. On the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1970. That was the day 350,000 GM workers kicked off a 67-day strike. It was the largest auto strike since the end of World War II. According to historian Jefferson Cowie, it was likely the costliest. In his book, Stayin' Alive, Cowie notes that the strike cost GM $1 billion in profits and nearly bankrupted the union. But he adds it, quote, lacked the proletarian drama that fired journalists' hearts. For Cowie, it was an example of labor management cooperation, a civilized affair. But historian Jeremy Breacher points out that the Wall Street Journal drew different conclusions about the strike at the time. In a series of articles, the paper noted that labor management cooperation during the strike served ironically to get workers back to work. A long and costly strike served a number of functions. It wore down strikers' expectations. After 8 or 10 weeks, workers would be amiable to terms they initially rejected. It also provided an escape valve for built-up frustration over working conditions. And a long strike served to coalesce internal union factions around a common enemy, strengthening the union's leadership in the process. For management, a long and costly strike lent hope that workers would be reluctant to strike in the future. But Breacher notes these ideas about workers' motives nearly backfired. Strikers simply wouldn't budge on their demands. They made gains in wages, pensions, and cost of living allowances. And they were finally able to retire after 30 years. But critics argued the agreement fell short of initial demands, and workers lacked more say in the workplace. This would be a key issue in the many strikes and wildcats in the years to come.
For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Here at the Rick Smith Show, we don't accept corporate advertising. Never have, never will. In fact, we spend most of our time giving corporations the finger. We don't stop the show every few minutes to sell you supplements, beet juice, or whatever snake oil the right-wing loonies are pawning. That's because we're not sellouts. It's also because we're supported by our friends in labor and by people like you. If you like what we do, become a patron by going to patreon.com/Rick Smith Show. That's patreon.com/Rick Smith Show. Give what you can, if you can, and help us fight for the working class majority. Because together we bargain, divided we beg. Thank you for tuning in.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I'm looking at the results of the recall in California yesterday, and wow, polling not even close. Originally, they said this was kind of a toss-up. Uh-oh, Newsom could get recalled. We could end up with a crazy guy as the governor of California. Somebody who believed that we'd have to give white landowners in the South reparations, which is weird. But yeah, there he was. He was going to be the next governor. And there was all this talk. It was possible. It was possible. And then the polling came back. Well, maybe not so much. It'll be close. But 64% that said, no, we don't want this governor recalled. In fact, it was even higher than the vote that he got in 2018, which was somewhere around, I guess, like 62%. So he actually performed better in the recall. So, hey, all of the moneyed interests who are pushing for this, congratulations. You made him even evidently even more popular. So good job. And here to share some thoughts on the results of yesterday's recall in California, I've asked Eve Levinson to come talk with us. She's the National Youth Advisor for Grassroots Democrats HQ. Their website, grassrootsdems.org. Eve, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much for having me on. We're really excited as a Californian, as somebody who works at the Grassroots Dem HQ. The results of yesterday are really exciting and show really how much the grassroots has worked, but also hopefully a good sign for the public support of Democratic policies. So thanks so much for having me on to discuss it.
No, I think it's important. And look, I was happy to see the results that came back. I wanted a big decisive victory, you know, especially in these things where you don't get a lot of turnout. I thought it was important because I knew the Republican base would be all lathered up in the panties to run out there and throw the guy out. So it shows me that the Democrats were pretty pumped up as well to get out and vote for this.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that what we saw in the polls is that sort of like 2 weeks ago, there wasn't necessarily that same excitement and support. But then we really saw a full court press from everybody from the grassroots and the California American Party, who had been working this long time. The Grassroots Dem HQ had been doing phone banks and had really shifted over most of our operation away from the general focus to focus on this. We really saw in the last 2 weeks a sort of national effort and push that I think really made a big difference in making sure that people knew that they needed to go out and vote. Because what we know is that there, of course, are more registered Democrats in the state of California than Republicans. But I think the early polls really show why that voter engagement is so important. If a voter doesn't realize an election is happening or why the election is so important, that's when we're at risk.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, this is such a decisive victory. That, you know, not even the Trumpkins can go, oh my God, they cheated. Oh my God, they stuffed the ballot box. Dead people were voting. And what I expected to wake up to that this morning.
Yeah. No, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the reality is when you win by, I think right now it's still a 2-1 margin, that you really can't have an instance of the claims of voter suppression really can't be there. I think that's why it's so important, not just that we won, but that we won by a landslide, because this wasn't just about California. This was also about showing support for science, showing support for vaccines, and also making sure that we really can move beyond this and not have to waste any more time or money with any sort of dispute over whether or not the election was valid. And I think that that's the reality, that this recall should have never happened. Newsom showed that he won by more than he won in the original race. And now it's time to push our grassroots efforts back to 2021 and 2022. The reality is that the Grassroots MHQ made 490,000 phone calls, sent 223,000 postcards, knocked on 5,100 doors, and engaged 3,500 volunteers. And that's incredible. But also now we need to get back to focusing on keeping Virginia blue in 2021 and keeping the Senate and the House in 2022.
Right. No, absolutely. Without question. How much do you give Greg Abbott credit for the win there in California? Because I got to be honest, the Texas rapist Bill of Rights seems to have generated a lot of activity here. How much played into California? And I don't actually know how it played out there. That's why I'm asking. How much of that played into what you saw there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we would have won in California whether or not that had been the case. I do think, though, the reality is that reproductive justice is a really important issue for so many people, so many young people like myself. I'm 21. I think that this was sort of the first instance in which we saw how much Roe v. Wade is at stake, which hasn't really been a reality in our lifetime before. We obviously, it was an issue. It was a talking point of the 2016 election. It's something that made me want to get out and do everything I could to support Hillary Clinton. However, I think that there's a difference between when you actually see that reality and when you see the court ruling that way. So I think definitely, I think everything played a role in it. But I think what we saw from the exit polls is that COVID was the primary factor that drove voters to the polls on all sides of the aisle. And obviously it drove more of our peoples to the polls because there were more Democrats to go and vote and support to keep Newsom.
Right. So would you agree that maybe DeSantis in Florida was more responsible than Abbott then? Because
I mean, I don't want to ever credit a Republican with our successes. I think that we win because we have the better policies and because we have the better grassroots game as well.
No, that's where I was going to go with this, because the policy of, well, we're not going to do anything. And we'll just let people die. That doesn't seem to be really popular.
No, it isn't. And I think that's what we saw. And what we saw, especially when I was doing these vote banks, was that our volunteers weren't just from California. There were people from all over the country because everybody was so concerned about what was going to happen, which as a Californian was kind of something nice to see, as somebody who has spent so much time working and volunteering for campaigns in other states, to sort of see that grassroots energy come back, because we knew that this was a referendum on science, on Democrats' response to COVID, and we showed up both in volunteers nationwide and voters in California.
Yeah, it was a big deal. Now, going forward, I mean, I'm hoping that this is a springboard to bigger and better things, because we're going to need it in 2022, especially if we don't get anything done on the infrastructure front, which the fear is the circular firing squad is being convened. But we need the youth vote. We need the young people to come out and vote in numbers like they haven't in years past. And I know your organization is working to do that. So how is that going? How are you working in that world?
Definitely. I will just say, I think on the infrastructure point, I still have hope. I think that, you know, Speaker Pelosi and the other leaders really have shown that they are good to having this dual approach. So I think we will get the infrastructure package, and that'll be something that we can tout to voters in 2022. But the reality is, no matter how much or how little is accomplished, we still need to keep our majorities. And so specifically, what we're working on right now in 2021 is a program to contact 90,000 young voters ages 18 to 29 in the state of Virginia to ensure we keep the House of Delegates and that we elect Hala Ayala to be the first ever woman of color elected statewide in Virginia, and also ensure that we keep the Virginia governor's house blue by reelecting Terry. And so that's really what we're working on, working with groups in Virginia, working with another youth group called Blue Future to be able to contact those 90,000 young voters, make sure they're registered to vote, make sure they turn out to vote, and make sure they vote for Democrats in those key districts. And then we hope that once that works out, that we can replicate the program in the Virginia congressional districts in 2022, in addition to expanding to Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. So that's a focus. And I think that method sort of having youth-led programs targeting voters in specific districts and also reaching out to them both with on the issues they care about is really how we're going to make a difference in reaching voters where they are, which young voters, which tends to be on college campuses, obviously. So traditional on-campus organizing is important, but also on social media and also through text. We need to invest in texting young voters, because value is a lot of young voters are less likely to answer their phones. We should still call them, but when a campaign or a group is investing in texting, I think that targeting that towards young voters is definitely one of the best ways to invest that resource.
Yeah, you got to reach people where they are. I'm an old school organizer. I still believe face-to-face, shaking someone's hand, having a conversation is Absolutely. The best way, but when talking to my kids, I actually text them.
Yeah.
We're in the same house. We're basically sitting next to each other, and I still text them because it's the world that we now live in, right?
Yeah. Well, and also a lot of young voters like me, if you went and you tried to canvass me at my house, I probably wouldn't be there because I'm in school right now on the other side of the country. But if you text me, my phone number is going to stay the same as whatever is in the voter file. So I think that that's really important when you think about how to engage young people where they are.
So what does your generation think of, you know, like here in Pennsylvania, our state Senate just decided that they want to subpoena all of the voting records for every voter in the state. They want to compile all this information on everyone because there was all of these nefarious activities that they kept throwing out and the courts kept throwing out. What's the thought on some of these outlandish claims of all this voter fraud and voter suppression that are being made?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that what we know is that those claims of voter fraud are so far and few between that they really rarely happen. And what the real issue is voter suppression. I think that that's why it's so important that we get legislation passed. I'm a big proponent of the John Lewis Voting Rights Act and the For the People Act. And I think that if what can get through the Senate is the new compromise that came out today with Joe Manchin's support, then that's definitely better than nothing. Obviously, if there's a way to get the more sweeping reforms through, that's what I prefer. But time is really running out to be able to get that legislation passed, to have it be able to be in effect by the 2022 election. But I think the larger issue than so-called cases of voter fraud is really the voter suppression that we see that's targeting marginalized groups, communities of color, young people, disabled voters, the voters that we know are really the ones who are most affected by the policies that are being considered and that the elections make a difference for.
Yeah, and going after poor people. I mean, it's the way that Republicans have identified and how they can, the only way that they can win is to make sure. And this isn't new. I mean, this goes back to 1980 and Paul Weyrich, you know, saying, you know, we don't want everybody voting. We want, you know, our people to vote, but not them. And they've moved policy, heaven and earth, to get to the point where they've been able to do that. You know, starting in 2000 when you had Al Gore, who won the election, you know, basically having that taken from him because Florida decided voting while black is a crime. But in going forward with the legislation, because here's the problem, and we got a big problem. It's never getting 60 votes. It's never going to get past cloture. And I don't see an appetite with the Democrats to undo the filibuster. How do you see this getting through?
I mean, I think that we have seen some inclination of that. I think that there's a possibility of there being a carve out in the filibuster. And I know that we've seen some reports of that happening. So I think that it's about, we need to keep on pushing for that on the legislative side, but we also need to plan. And it's now the organizing for 2022 has already started, and we need to just sort of do both at the same time. And obviously not everybody can do 100% of both at the same time, but it's important to be involved in at least one, I think. So, I mean, I think the reality is, I think it's unlikely we get 60 votes. That being said, I think a carve-out might be more likely than a total abolition of the filibuster.
So where do you find yourself on the filibuster? Do you think we should abolish it? Think we should be carving it up and putting, you know, holes in it like Swiss cheese? How do you see that?
I personally think that I would not be too upset if the filibuster went away. That being said, I understand that it's not necessarily the most realistic thing at this time. I think that what's most important is getting the legislation passed that's going to support the people of America. And so I think that whether that's a carve out, whether that's abolishing it, whichever way we can get help to the American people as quickly as possible is the most important. And sometimes that's going to be pushing certain bills through reconciliation.
Yeah, I've been saying for a while we should be pushing more reconciliation bills. Congress has the ability to pass 13 budget bills a year. In fact, they're supposed to. They used to. They used to have 13 individual budget bills, and they used to pass them. They haven't done it in a number of years. But for me, I think that's 13 bites at the apple to take a lot this big plan and move a lot of little ones that are a lot easier to message and a lot easier to digest to get people behind. Because look, this $3.5 trillion spending plan, is very popular when you start telling people what's in it. When you stop demonizing it and saying, oh, just wasteful spending. It's actually investments in communities and people getting educations and your generation not being saddled with a lifetime of student loan debt.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. And I think that that's what hopefully we will see come out of the budget discussions that are happening. But again, I think that while we're pushing for these legislative fights, it's also really important that we are keeping our eye on the elections, because the reality is there are no off years. And that's both because there are things like recalls that come up and off year elections in Virginia, but also because working for elections is a year round activity. You need to have the sustained organizing and the sustained voter contact. You can't just come in the 3 months before.
Yeah, see, here's the thing, and this is where there's part of me that goes, I wish we could return to the days where elections were just for 3 months. I think a lot of people are burnt out at the constant, the 24/7, 365 election cycle, that the day that you get elected, you're running for re-election. In fact, I've got friends in Congress who tell me, you know, the day that they get elected, they're raising money for the next election, which takes so much time away from them doing the kind of work that they need to do. And there's my set, you go, I wish we could have 3 months, duke it out for 3 months, beat each other bloody if we have to, and then election day, let's get some stuff done.
Yeah, I mean, I think though there's also a part of organizing that's not necessarily just solely electoral organizing, but it's about building power within communities. It's about ensuring that folks are trained up, that you're working on whatever that community needs. And so I think that what we saw is a lot of Democratic campaigns at the beginning of the coronavirus were not really focused necessarily getting out the vote, but were focused on ensuring that people had what they needed, supporting mutual aid. And so I think that when I say like year-round organizing, that's also what that includes. But then I think that when there are Republican distraction tactics that come up, like the recall campaign, that really puts a rent in that sort of more sustained organizing and the investing in those communities that are both important electorally, but also important because all communities and all people are important.
Now, I'm glad you said that, because I look at this recall as this was busy work. This was the rich people of this country going, let's throw a little wrench into the system. Let's make people spend resources and spin their wheels to try and defend Newsom, knowing that I got to believe they knew they weren't going to win. But this was about stopping progress. This was about giving Biden a black eye, potentially. This was about gumming up the system just enough to, well, you know, cause a little chaos.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think that that's exactly right. This recall election, we knew that Democrats controlled California. We still know that Democrats and Californians want Newsom. But the reality is it was a distraction tactic. And so now what we have to do is we need to get back to focusing on the legislative fights and looking to the Virginia election is less than 2 months away. That's very soon, right around the corner. And we need everybody who put all their attention in California, who phone banked, who donated, who wrote letters, who knocked doors. We need that same effort now to be put towards the Virginia legislative cycle.
And how can people help? I know going to your website, grassrootsdems.org.
I would say go to our website, grassrootsdems.org. The HQ is going to be, in addition to the youth program I discussed, also be working directly with the coordinated campaign and different House of Delegates campaigns. So there will be opportunities for phone banking and texting and postcarding from around the country, in addition to opportunities to support canvassing for folks who are in the area as well. So the website, definitely the best place to go. And I also will be definitely putting out a lot about that on my social media. As a college student in DC, I think it's really important that we go and put our boots on the ground and knock on those doors in Virginia as well.
We got a lot of work to do. And what kind of things can, you know, from Pennsylvania, from Michigan, from Alaska, what can people do to help real quick?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, obviously, folks who have the ability to support monetarily, that's always helpful. But also there's texting voters, writing postcards and notes to voters, and calling voters. The best form of voter contact that folks can help with from out of state is really that calling voters. And that's, you're going to see a lot more volunteer opportunities coming from the Grassroots Dem HQ for Virginia in the coming days.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Grassrootsdems.org, the website. We'll get links out on social media. Eva, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Good stuff. Again, the website, grassrootsdems.org. We'll get some links out on how you can help keep Virginia. And maybe we can push Virginia to undo their horrible no rights at work agenda and get rid of right to work laws there. Just my thought. Love to hear yours. You can email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1931. That was the day that came to be known as the Invergordon Mutiny in Scotland. The global depression had begun to sweep across Europe. In response to the economic crisis, the British government began cutting the pay of public sector workers. This included those in the armed forces. This came at a time when more workers were joining the armed forces because of the rising unemployment that ravaged the private sector. For those in the Navy, the proposed pay cuts were 10% for officers and as high as 25% for those under the rank of petty officer. As news of the pay cuts spread, sailors at Invergordon held meetings to discuss their response. Invergordon, Scotland, had become an important harbor for the British fleet during World War I. The sailors decided to strike. On the day of the strike, several ships were scheduled to participate in exercises. But the sailors on four vessels refused to take their ships out of the harbor. Many men did not report for duty. Naval leaders gave in quickly, reducing the severity of the pay cuts. But many of the leaders of the strike faced reprisals. Some were jailed. Others were drummed out of the Navy. Spies for the Admiralty went below decks to monitor the sailors and report those who might cause future trouble. Government leaders tried to keep the news of the strike out of the news. But workers' rallies against public sector cuts spread to cities like Glasgow and London. The strike also caused a panic at the London Stock Exchange.
Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, sad day. This is one of those days that's just kind of infuriating that everybody agrees we should be doing things to lower the price of prescription drugs. Everybody. I don't know anyone who goes, no, Rick, we're Americans, damn it. We pay full price. We pay retail. In fact, we pay above retail. I don't know anybody who... That's not true. I do know some lobbyists who work for Big Pharma who think, oh, no, we want full price because that's how they get their salaries paid. But the average everyday working people that I know, they're tired of being mugged over the cost of prescription drugs. So to have three Democrats come out and who have taken almost $2 million in campaign cash from Big Pharma come out and say, no, we're not going to help. That's infuriating to me. And here to share some thoughts on just how bad this is, I've asked Laura Packard to come talk with us. Laura's a stage four cancer survivor and the executive director of Healthcare Voter. Their website, healthcarevoter.com. Laura, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So am I getting this right? We've got these three Democrats, Kurt Schrader, Scott Peters of California, Kathleen Rice of New York, said, no, we're happy where the drug prices are at this moment. We don't need anything to help lower them. Am I getting this right?
Yes. In committee today, in the House Energy and Commerce Committee, those three voted against a provision to lower the cost of prescription drugs. And because of that vote, it was tied and it is not a part of the Build Back Better bill. However, this is not the end of it. Ways and Means is working on a provision, and the Senate side is working on a provision. So this is not done. This is just the first step, but it is not a good first step.
Yeah. No, this is one of those things where you look at all of the, you know, and there aren't a lot of Democrats who are the ones who are getting the shotgun ready for the circular firing squad, but there are enough. You got a couple in the House, these three. You've got, you know, a couple in the Senate that seem to just want to, well, gum up any progress. And for what I think are just ridiculous kind of reasons, for me, if they don't get anything done, they're all done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and these weak need Pharma 3, they were more than happy to vote for the bill in 2019 when it didn't matter, when Mitch McConnell's Senate was a graveyard for progressive bills. But now that it actually matters, all of a sudden they have concerns. And maybe those concerns all of a sudden popped up because Big Pharma is dropping seven figures on ad campaigns. But this is a popular, popular issue across the board, regardless of political party. Americans think we spend too much on prescription drugs, and they're right. We pay more than any other country. And this is their chance to do something about it. And today they whiffed because they were listening to their Big Pharma donors instead of their own constituents.
So what's the argument? What's their concern? I mean, I listened to Joe Manchin talk about the $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill. And his concern is now he cares about the debt. Now he cares about deficits. Now he's had this come to Jesus moment where debt and deficit now matter. Didn't hear much the last several years, but now when we're going to get some things that we need, now it seriously matters. But these three, where do you see that?
Well, they say that they care about the poor, poor pharmaceutical companies not having the money to develop new drugs, except for this is one of the most profitable industries in the country. And why is it that Americans have to pay so many times more for this innovation and nobody else in the world has to pay these prices? Now, the big pharmaceutical companies are marketing companies. They don't put their money into R&D anyway. It's the small companies that develop the drugs and then get bought up by the big companies. And then the big companies market the hell out of it. So it's not even that they need the money for research. It's they need more money to shower it on their executives and stock buybacks. It'd be one thing if they were actually doing the development, but they aren't. All of the innovation that doesn't come from research we already paid for through the NIH is coming from these smaller companies that just then get bought.
No, and I think that's something important to make sure people understand, because our government spends an awful lot of money on research through the NIH, as you point out, and through our universities. I mean, our universities are the incubator of a lot of breakthrough discoveries, as they should be. I mean, this is part of the reason why we want to have the world's best higher education system, and why I think we should be funding them at a much higher rate. And maybe, just maybe, if we'd taken some of those patents that they created and let them hold on to them and profit from them, maybe we could fund education instead of, you know, more boats and whatever for the billionaires who run our big pharma companies.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And if it's so important that we be putting money into R&D, then how about we cut the price of prescription drugs and beef up NIH funding so that we can all benefit from it, as opposed to only specific stockholders of a specific company. So their arguments don't hold water, but unfortunately their wallet does. So yeah, that's why these politicians are listening.
Yeah, I have a friend who's hell-bent on reimportation of drugs. His answer to our problem is, just let me buy them from Canada or from the UK or from India. Let me buy the same drugs I can get from my pharmacy from freaking India because it's cheaper. And you go, what sense does that make? Why don't we just make the cost cheaper here so we can buy them from here? What about that?
Mm-hmm. And the whole idea of reimportation, that the reason why it's cheaper in every other country is every other country is using their bargaining power to push down the cost of the drugs. We're the only ones that have our hands tied behind our back, and we don't use the purchasing power of the American government to get cheaper prices. So trying to take another country's supply is just ridiculous. We're not practicing the willpower we need right here at home to get our own cheaper prices.
That's incredible to me. I mean, and we can thank George W. Bush for this and the Republicans who rammed through the we're never going to pay anything but retail for prescription drugs with the Medicare Part, what was it, Part D is what they rammed through, mm-hmm. Along with privatizing portions of Medicare because, hey, we believe in the free market. And so I'm in this spot where you believe in the free market, but we can't negotiate for prices, which is, I don't know, isn't that one of the main tenets of the free market, that you have the ability to negotiate or to abstain? Isn't that kind of like the central definition?
Exactly. And also, let's talk some more about this amazing research that's supposed to be producing these drugs. When you look at a drug like insulin, that they jack up the prices year after year after year, and it's the same drug that was discovered decades ago. Or look at what PharmaBro did in taking a drug that had been around a long time that people depended on, and then he jacked it 700% because he could. It's not that they're spending the money, or they're spending a small fraction of money on development compared to their big marketing budgets.
But what do you say to the argument, Laura, that, you know, if we don't allow them to pursue these obscene profits, that if we don't protect their patents, that if we don't do the status quo, that eventually they're just going to stop, and then we'll have nothing. We'll all be standing around, you know, looking at each other, drug-free. What's the argument against that?
So these private companies need guaranteed profits to exist, because that doesn't sound like any sort of free enterprise. Why do they need the guaranteed customer paying top dollar in order to make a profit? Run your business better.
Yeah, see, that seems rational to me. And again, I go back to this, you know, this economies of scale thing. The federal government is the largest purchaser of drugs in the world. And they've given up the only leverage that you really could possibly have in helping taxpayers, because eventually we pay for all of it, as do seniors overwhelmingly who consume these drugs. It seems to me that this would be a win for them to say, no, now we need to go. So while we're focused on these three Democrats, who I got to be honest, you know, I got problems with right now, but there's still 200 Republicans who voted no too. There are still every Republican who said, no, we don't care about taxpayers. We don't care about seniors. We don't care about the price of drugs. They didn't come along either.
Mm-hmm. And just like Trump said he would do something about drug prices, he talked and talked and talked and never delivered. He talked and talked and talked about a great health insurance program and never delivered on that either. Republicans are all talk and no action unless their action is voting down good ideas.
Yeah, no, you got that exactly right. And since you brought up Trump's plan, because I actually had someone bring that up to me not too long ago that said, you know, Donald Trump had a great plan and Democrats blocked it. I'm going, I don't remember him coming out with a plan. I do remember for a while saying he had a plan. It was secretly locked away on a whole bunch of pages. And it came in the same pack that you could buy the ream at the Staples, a whole bunch of blank pages, because there's no idea there. But do you remember anything that Trump came out with that would have given access to health care to people, would have expanded access, would have, you know, lowered prices for health care and drugs? Do you remember anything like that?
Well, the health care plan never came, but his drug plan, first of all, was he was going to issue drug rebate cards to seniors that had his name written all over it. So that was the drug card bribe. And then it turned out that wasn't exactly legal, so that didn't happen. And then he issued an executive order that said, we're going to pay cheaper prices. And it turned out that wasn't really exactly legal and well done either. So he was the kid that tried to do his homework 2 minutes before it was due, and unsurprisingly, it was full of errors.
Yeah, no. Now that that's starting to come back, I forgot all about the executive order, which was magically, everyone's going to pay lower prices because I say so. Snap the fingers, done.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not so easy. The Biden administration just released their drug plan a few days ago, and it's easy to come up with plans. It's harder to execute them, and that's what we're seeing out of Congress.
So
I have faith. It's not over, but we have a ways to go.
No, I'm hopeful. But, you know, in looking at Biden's plan, what's in it? What do you think is possible? Do you think something gets done? After all, we still have to figure out how to either get to the 60 threshold or somehow tuck it into the budget reconciliation. What's in it? Where do you see the path forward?
Well, his plan includes the things that Congress is working on now. Also, some work on the executive side, some things that he can do via regulations. And something I'm very interested in his plans is looking at monopolies and putting a lot more scrutiny on healthcare monopolies that raise the costs for all of us. So I think having a robust FTC, having a robust executive branch that is actually paying attention and working for consumers means a lot of this shady stuff that companies have gotten away with before, they hopefully won't be able to get away with anymore.
Now, you're someone who, unfortunately, has consumed an awful lot of healthcare, you know, as you went through cancer and through your life. You know, you look at this and what would it have meant to have, you know, health security that you didn't have to constantly be worrying about the bills, worrying about potentially going bankrupt? Because I'm in this mindset that I think the average everyday working person just wants to make sure that if they get sick, they're going to get covered. I don't think most people care if it's a private employer plan or if it's a government plan. I think they just want to make sure that they have the security of knowing that if they get cancer like you did, or if their kid falls off the monkey bars and breaks an arm, that they don't have to worry about bankruptcy. I think most people are in that world.
Right. I mean, most people are not health insurance policy experts. They just want to have the security of knowing that if something happens, they're covered. And it's become an ordeal every year to go through all the plans and figure out what's the right situation and hope that it'll really cover you when you need it. And things have gotten better, certainly, through the Affordable Care Act and until now, but it's still not an easy process. And you shouldn't have to be a healthcare expert to just be able to have the coverage you need.
No, I mean, And that's the right example. I mean, I keep hearing people say, well, you know, I shouldn't have to pay for things that I don't need. I'm going, well, you need everything. You need to make sure that if something happens, you're covered. And it's this kind of piecemealing that I'm concerned about. Well, you know, I need this. I don't need that. I need to be covered. I need to know that when I get sick, I'm going to see a doctor, that doctor is going to be sane and he's going to have credentials and he's going to follow the right path and get me as well as possible. I think we want that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I believe that most Americans want everybody to have health care. And there's a lot of fighting about the details, but I believe our hearts are all in the right place. I just wish that more of our elected officials listened to their people instead of to their donors.
Yeah, good point. So getting back to this, you said that this fight isn't over. It's going through another committee that's potentially going to be in the bill. What are the chances of the bill getting passed overall? I mean, I'm looking at Joe Manchin. I'm looking at, you know, Sinema, which I guess the president today had a meeting with both of them. There doesn't seem to be a lot of urgency from the two of them to get something forth, even though we desperately need it. How do you see this playing out?
Well, there isn't a lot of room for error. You know, we need every single vote in the Senate, and we can only spare a small handful of votes in the House. This is assuming, of course, that no Republican will vote for health care. And unfortunately, in the world we live in, it appears that no Republican will vote for health care. So anyways, assuming that there are no sane Republicans that are willing to vote in favor of their own constituents, then we don't have a lot of room to maneuver. But Nancy Pelosi is one of the best vote counters the House has ever had. So I have my faith in Nancy Pelosi and my faith in all of these legislators that at the end of the day, even if they are not putting their constituents first, they'll hopefully put their own butts first and make sure that they pass something so that Democrats have something to run on next year.
No, that's the line right there. You got to have something that you've actually gotten done, that you've actually produced to say, hey, this is how we've made your life better. We brought some bacon home and this is why you vote for us again. Because my fear, and I said this from day one, my fear is one side says, no, we're not going to vote on anything but the hard infrastructure bill. One side says, well, if we're not getting the other side, you're not getting this. And at the end of the road, we're sitting here with nothing in either hand. And then, you know, coming out to the voters in 2022 going, oops.
Yeah. And I mean, if that's what happens, it's understandable if the voters say to heck with this and vote people out. So even if these elected officials are hearing from, you know, the money people, don't do this, don't do this, don't raise taxes, don't hurt the big corporations or whatever. If they don't do anything, they aren't going to have a job to to work from after that. So I hope that they're at least listening to the polling and seeing how important these healthcare reforms are to Americans.
Especially because they're very popular. Look, you know, the numbers, the polling numbers are really high on this stuff. But Laura, I appreciate you taking some time for us, keeping us up to date on what's going on there in Congress and getting us motivated to get some stuff done. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And contact your representatives.
There you go. Our good friend, Laura Packard. Make sure you check out the work that she's doing, laurapackard.com. She's the executive director there of Healthcare Voter. Make sure you check out their website, healthcarevoter.com, as well. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I want to take a second to tell you about our friends over at the Political Voices Network. PVN is a new network dedicated to promoting left-leaning voices like The Stephanie Miller Show, The Tom Hartman Program, Richard French Live, and of course, The Rick Smith Show. To find these great shows and lots of other great content, go to politicalvoicesnetwork.com and help us pull the plug on the corporate-controlled mainstream media. And as always, thank you for your support.